Yes, I'm delighted to be here. I was here in 1992. I will read a little bit from the talk I gave on that occasion. I was very deeply honored because it was the first T.B. Davey Memorial Lecture on Academic Freedom after the lifting of apartheid. And it was a great honor for me, not only a great honor, but a great challenge to think of what it was that I could say on such an occasion. And so that occasion is really engraved in my memory in very important ways. The topic today is the tradition of the critique and some texts of feminism. Incidentally, I should say, especially to young scholars here, although it is easy to think, as you did, and it's completely fine, you're in the law faculty, there's no reason for you to read an old book on Yeats, that Myself Must I Remake is not my dissertation. I was discouraged by a senior faculty member on my new job. I was discouraged from publishing my dissertation. I'm going to give chapter 4 for the first time at Yale, I think, in April. That was a book I wrote for young adults because I felt it was the 1960s, and I felt that my undergraduates did not understand critical books, so it's actually not my dissertation. It's such as it is. And also, I'm not the founder of Subaltern Studies. My God, Ranajit Guha, you know, he still sits in Vienna, a big man whose nickname was and is the Pope. You know, you hear the story, right? I cannot claim that. Okay. So now I think I've paid my debts and I can begin. The tradition of the critique and some texts of feminism. This is how I understand the tradition of the critique by way of a polarization of critique on one side and dogma on the other. To think critically is to think only in reference to our cognitive faculties. I'm quoting the English translation of the definition given by Immanuel Kant. To think only in reference to our cognitive faculties and consequently to the subjective condition of thinking, without undertaking to decide something about its object. To think dogmatically is to think something as contained under another concept of the object, which constitutes a principle of reason, and then determine it in conformity with this. Disciplinary philosophers in the audience will forgive me if I produce a rule of thumb translation. A critical look is to look as far as possible through an awareness of the subjective structures of production of the thinking, rather than immediately think of it as correct, connected to an object of thinking, to a seemingly pre-existing objective fact, and start developing an action. In the short run, you have to do the dogmatic bit. Not a problem. But we are sitting here at a university. And so yesterday, as I was speaking to a much smaller group, Harry, you liked the fact that again and again I reminded people that I could only speak in terms of a stereotype of myself, rather than simply say, look it, this is what I mean, and you must not say I mean something else. No, it is you who will understand what I mean. I cannot as much as you can. So to an extent, this comes from the tradition of the critique. The entire thing then comes from Kant, to whom I came on my own when I was trying to write the introduction to the translation of a complex philosophical text by the Algerian French philosopher Jacques Derrida. I had had no instruction in philosophy at all before then. That was when I began reading Kant carefully. This was in the 70s. It was in 1992, in response to an invitation from this university, that I was pushed to think of how we, the colonial class would use the tarnished legacy of the European Enlightenment in the aftermath of colonialism. And I'm quoting a little bit, and this is going into my forthcoming book, which, if I finish proofreading, is out in January. I quote, "In 1992, asked to give the first T.B. Davy Memorial Lecture at the University of Cape Town after the lifting of apartheid, I suggested that we learn to use the European Enlightenment from below. I used the expression ab use because the Latin prefix ab says much more than below, indicating both motion away." Okay, think of all of this in terms of put it next to use, motion away, and agency, point of origin, supporting, as well as the duties of slaves. It nicely captures the double bind of the post-colonial and the metropolitan migrant regarding the Enlightenment. We want, and you know, when I say we, in general, if I mean the U.S. faculty folk, I will indicate that because, you know, I have to code switch. This is my 46th year of full-time teaching in the United States. So sometimes that's the we, institution building we. But in general, the we that comes is this person born in British India who was the first generation of post-colonial sort of adolescents growing up. That's the we that you should hear. When, I mean, and also feminism, right, a kind of proto-feminism, right? My mother knew how to play the lati, the truncheon, and it learned from Pulindash, if that name means anything to anyone. So one of the big so-called terrorist instructors, and also was a member of the All India Women's Congress, a wonderful woman. So therefore, this is the we that I mean when I say we, and sometimes something else, and I'll tell you. So, we want the public sphere gains and private sphere constraints of the Enlightenment. Yet, we must also find something relating to our own history to counteract the fact that the Enlightenment came to colonizer and colonized alike through colonialism to support a destructive free trade, and that top-down policy breaches of Enlightenment principles are more rule than exception. This distinguishes our efforts from the best in the modern European attempts to use the European Enlightenment critically, with which we are in sympathy enough to subvert. Now, the word sabotage means to make it impossible to use. But we must give to the word sabotage a new affirmative definition. It's really to take, learn how to use, turn it around, and use it for gains that perhaps it was not indicated for initially. And that's an affirmative use of the word sabotage rather than sabote, which simply means to do something so that this thing can't be used anymore. So, but abuse can be a misleading neographism when you write it, abuse, ab hyphen use, and come to mean simply abuse. That should be so far from our intentions that I thought to sacrifice precision and range and simply say from below, use from below. But this too rankles, for it assumes that we, whoever we are below the level of the Enlightenment. So it's a kind of double bind, and there'll be double binds all along the way. We can talk about them. I hope there is a lecture, there's a question session. Because sometimes in these sort of course, the community comes, wonderful. Because sometimes at these sort of named vice-chancellor lectures, you talk and go, bye, go to dinner. And you see, it's only the question session that instructs me. All these years, you know, I'm bored by the sound of my voice. I try to be as honest as possible. But I'd much rather hear from you. So therefore, please ask me questions. The double bind is a good question to ask. See? All right. See, no one, everybody's scared to death. No one wants to ask anything. Double bind. Okay. Thinking this way, you know, first of all, critical rather than dogmatic, and then the abuse of the Enlightenment, we can ask the question, can feminism afford the important call of the tradition of the critique? Mary Wollstonecraft and Kant were contemporaries. Kant died just short of 80, Wollstonecraft at 38, giving birth to the future Mary Shelley. If one thinks of Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, one inevitably thinks, and rightly so, of course, of the French Revolution, of Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man, and of the fact that these, with cultural modifications and translations, have come to stand for inalienable human rights. And if they are inalienable, then that is natural law, isn't it? Natural law, positive law. Now, don't kill me. I'm trying to move into areas where I know nothing, but natural law, positive law, one can say. So at any rate, that's what one thinks when one reads Wollstonecraft. However, Kant, in a position where he did not have to think about making a good statement about rights, was able to see in his own way, not so much in his much-lauded political writings, as this is another question that someone might want to ask me, what do you mean? Kant took such a fine anti-colonial position, and you're saying not so much in his much-lauded political writings? But I will say so. Kant, not so much in his much-lauded political writings, but as in his philosophical method, having the time to do so, he could say at the end of the 18th century, when it was necessary, nascent capitalist colonialism, not mercantile, but moving into serious stuff, right, industrial. So at the end of the 18th century, he had the time to say that mere reason had to be reined in. Mere reason, that's Kant, bloß vernunft. Mere reason, the fourth critique, had to be reined in, leading just as much to our world today, where all crisis is managed in the name of rational choice. For Kant, that is mere reason. And Kant's description of mere reason is that it is morally lazy, I quote. Allow me to digress for a moment in the name not of rational choice, but of the humanities, and suggest how it is that unconstrained rational choice rules the world today. I will use the word utopia. Utopia comes from the root meaning of the word, that it is a no place, a good place. If you make a mistake deliberately and spell that U as EU, then you can say, like the Evangel, the good news, right? It's actually a no place, but you, by making that little mistake, you can call it a good place that we try to approximate. It can never be achieved because it is, in fact, a no place. The utopia proposed by globalization is a level playing field. I think it is generally understood that this is a false promise, especially since the impossibility inherent in all utopian thought is ignored by it. The world is run on the supposed aim to achieve it, more or less disingenuously. In order to make this false promise, the sponsors of globalization emphasize that access to capital brings in and creates social productivity. And this is very true. You know, all sort of corporate funding, international civil society, people all over the place. It creates social productivity, like job creation is a mantra. Let me not get into that hobby horse area, because I will talk too much about it. I should read on. But that's what they suggest. Only the social productivity of capital. They do not emphasize the fact that such productivity must and can only create general social good if it is humanely mediated by decision makers who are deeply trained in unconditional ethics. And with the decline and fall in education in the humanities, this group is nearly extinct. So this thing as to who is going to use that stuff, they don't exist, but you bring it forward, right? So even digital idealism, there is this and there is that, but there's nobody to use it. A long time ago in New York, artists had a phrase, monkeys with car keys. To an extent, that's the promise of the social productivity. there as the humanities are being being taken in. To the wise heads of this university, I repeat what I said to the president of the university, University of Toronto, which was kind enough to offer me my first honorary doctorate, as comparative literature was about to be closed, I said, and the students very much liked this remark. Think of education in the humanities as epistemological and ethical health care for the society at large. You know? Not a cash cow. And I live in the United States. I know I speak with deep anguish when I say this, and some of you, I hope, catch the irony of my saying this to Canada. Because, of course, Canada has a better healthcare system. But comparative literature is back at Toronto. Anyway, so in the absence of philosopher kings or queens directing the global utopia, what is also and necessarily ignored is that for capital to work in a capitalist way, there must be what used to be called proletarianization and today has been revised to subalternization. To open my remarks, I want to touch on a couple of other issues, but I want to talk a little bit about this achieving of utopia and gender and translation, and then I will come back to the question of the critique. In order to establish the same system, now the disciplinary economists, forgive me for speaking like an idiot, in order to establish the same system of exchange all over the world, the bottom line of globalization, the barriers between individual national economies and international capital have to be removed. When this happens, states lose their individual and idiosyncratic constitutional particularities in history and become recoded as agents for managing the interests of global capital. And as the world looks at South Africa, this is a play that, you know, at the time of the request to divest. I mean, I marched. I remember when I got the job at the University of Pittsburgh, it was a very important job. It was the first, I was the first woman of any color, race, creed, any age, whatever, what subject, any subject, anything, to get a Mellon professorship, right? It was a big deal. But the first thing that I did, to think of it, I blush with shame, was to stand with all the students because of the divestment issue, right? In front of the Vice Chancellor's building saying, you can't hide. I accuse you of genocide. See, because, so, you know, all of these issues, the issues of why good capital investment creates a better polity can't again. And then, you know, why and how it is necessary for us to think about constitutional redress, fantastic constitutions, looking at South Africa. But at the same time, how, under the first principle of globalization, as the state becomes a managerial state, that's the side that begins to become shadowy. So, and that's also knowing the humanities, isn't it? So, in such a situation, recoded as agents for managing the interests of global capital, when demand and supply begin to become the organizing principles of running a state, we come to realize that items such as clean water or HIV/AIDS research, let us say, do not necessarily come up in terms of the demands of the global economy. These kinds of needs then begin to be supervised by a global collection of agencies that are separate from the nation states. This group is often called the international civil society. So, to quote myself, I've said 1,000 times, self-selected moral entrepreneurs with no social contract. The international civil society, a more palliative description of what is also and still called non-governmental organization. So civics 101, learnt in undergraduate school, not state, civil society, isn't it? Actually, civil society is an altogether different thing. The international civil society, a more palliative description of what is also and still called non-governmental organizations supported by the United Nations. Thus, we can say that the structuring of the utopianism of globalization brings forth restructured states aided by an international civil society and other instruments of world governance. And quite often, research institutes in the Euro-US will ace the international civil society and will reach out toward the so-called global south universities to give clean water, HIV/AIDS help, public health maneuvers, which is deeply shaming for the universities themselves. It is well known that the management of gender provides alibis for all kinds of activities, from military intervention to various kinds of platforms of action, where experience deeply embedded in cultural difference is translated into general equivalence. I'm deliberately using an old Marxian phrase, right? General equivalent in the system of values, the first chapter, section 4 of Capital 1. You'll figure it out, the very well-known chapter. You'll figure it out why I say general equivalence. Use of gender to bring forth, translated into a general equivalent. Deeply embedded cultural difference translated into general equivalent. Often this happens because women are perceived to be a more malleable and fungible sector of society, especially women below a certain income line. If in a global utopia, it is also imagined that sexual preference would be translated into the language of general effective affective equivalence, this exists on a separate plane. We can see that in order to establish the same system of exchange all over the globe, we are also obliged to think of establishing the same system of gendering globally. And you see, this is also a double bind, because an ethical system cannot not, in fact, be uniform. This is a deep and problematic area, because we cannot say cultural ethics. Ethics are, you know, where we are human. On the other hand, it is easy to use equality as an alibi for uniformization, for the convenience of globalization. So it's a site of struggle, not just a word. And it is also true that equality is not sameness. There is a difference there. We can talk about that later. Within this context, the word humanities can become a code word for fundraising, because, you know, people fix on different kinds of things, and now humanities for purchased virtue looks good, because that means you're doing something like really okay. But what kind of humanities? So that's another question that we have to ask. But if the humanities are to be recoded as the human sciences, I want money for the humanities. Don't get me wrong. The thing that you didn't mention before, a quick fix intro, that was fantastic. I should have thanked you more. But because, you know, I give introductions when somebody tells me, hey, I got my eyes, whatchamacallit, and go give the introduction. I wouldn't have done as well as you did. But at any rate, I'm the only university professor in the humanities. So to an extent, I have a kind of responsibility to say, look, resources, more resources, and so on. So I'm not against it. I'm not an idealistic person. After all, I teach for money. But on the other hand, what are we recoding? If the humanities are to be recoded as the human sciences, including, as they should, the qualitative social sciences, then literature and philosophy, the old foundational humanities, must rethink their task and be allowed to share it with the entire spectrum of disciplines. Now, remember what I was saying. In order to use anything, you need people who are epistemologically prepared. I mean, I call them philosopher king and queen. You don't go that far. But how do you construct your object of knowledge? That's a very complicated thing. You know, everybody at home, I'll give you a simple example because these are big words. Everybody at home, not everybody, but, you know, I come from a family which is, I mean, larger family. I'm not talking about my little family that I adore beyond description. But in the larger family, I'm perceived as a very unhappy person. You know, in her 70s, no children, no husband, you know. But my mom really so deeply taught me to think of this as freedom that I can't somehow be depressed about this other judgment. What is that? It's an epistemological change that she made me do. I constructed my situation as an object of knowledge in this other way. It's crucial. This epistemological performance, imaginative training for epistemological performance so that it becomes natural, that is absolutely crucial for thinking social justice. This is not to be forgotten. So let's look at philosophy and literature, the foundational texts of foundational humanities. The bottom line of teaching literature as such, I'm not saying don't do literary history, don't do literary analysis, don't do distant reading, do what you like. I'm not a censor. But the bottom line of teaching literature as such is to teach how to read. In the most robust sense, it's bottom line ethical practice, because the only way to read is to suspend yourself in another's text. It's not that literature says good things. I mean, the mostly boring literature says good things. But what it does, it allows you to practice suspending yourself in another's text, which is preparation for being able to move and interrupt knowing when, in fact, so creating a reflex when, in fact, the ethical hits you. So this is something that we need to keep in mind. The bottom line of teaching literature as such is to teach how to read in the most robust sense. The bottom line of teaching philosophy as such is to teach how to think, doing, living, being, or even analytical philosophy is about this. So teaching how to, that is philosophizing. Teaching how to think again in the most, thank you for the little sitter, it was a joke. to teach how to think again in the most robust sense, it is to teach an activism of the imagination and intellect. It's not, that's, the substantive part is important for degrees and so on. But ideas of knowledge are not just knowledge about knowledge, and just to kind of learn, like Kant corrected Descartes, Hegel corrected Kant, Marx corrected Hegel, Freud, maybe Nietzsche. Nietzsche corrected Freud, Marx, Freud corrected Nietzsche, Habermas corrected Freud or whatever, you know. That way, his master's voice, right? And I am a Habermasian, therefore. That's not the way that one thinks. One thinks about this business of activism of imagination and intellect. What we must learn, we must know. You don't do it as ignoramuses. Universities have that task as well, but that's what they do. It is to teach how to play oneself as an instrument, distanced yet connected, reading, thinking. It is only a few, an unexpected joy for the teacher of these subjects who slide into being taught to play to lose. Very hard. You know, the ones who can really... I remember I never really learned to play tennis. Okay, I won a blue ribbon by default because no one else turned up. But my husband, on the other hand, was quite good. My first husband, Vivek, he was quite good. Tournament tennis he played, but he couldn't teach because he wasn't good enough to be able to lose his form, right? So this business of playing how to lose, that's a much harder, to be able to play with people who have not yet learned to win and who should. There are some who slide into this place. Anyone who's taught knows this. Who are going to be, who will know that in this kind of work, to win is to lose. Qui gagne perd. So in fact you can't lose either, because if you lose, what happened? Did you win? Since to win is to lose. So anyway, who slide into being taught to play to lose, the only way you can be a real teacher in the humanities. What is loss here? Do you want to lose when you play to lose? Did Socrates? Does the parent or the teacher? But who wins loses. A lesson I learned, I think, from deconstruction. A hall of mirrors. I mean, financial crisis tells you. A hall of mirrors, gain to loss to gain to loss, but what remains, that is how the foundational humanities function in critique. This then is the contemporary importance of the tradition of the critique. Kant is able to say that mere reason, which is morally lazy, should make room for the effects of grace. I will have much to say about the relationship between the effect of grace and the imagination constantly transforming belief into the intuition of the transcendental. Imagination transforming belief into the intuition of the transcendental. Here now, let us mark that moment more than 200 years ago when, speaking from the same period, in a spirit of competition, Mary Wollstonecraft did not have the permission to develop within the tradition of critique whether she followed Kant or not. This was the question I asked before I went into a digression. Can feminism afford to be in the critical tradition? Yesterday, I was talking about the fact that the situation in Palestine does not allow us to be pacifist ethical. So this situation is, that's a kind of bind which I'm describing in the case of Wollstonecraft in the 18th century, not able to claim the tradition of the critique, could not afford to claim the tradition of the critique. Now, when we read her, whether the opposition then is not between Wollstonecraft and the work that we do in what is called the Global South today, but realizing the constraints upon her voice, we also realize that this too is an untraditional use of the European Enlightenment. Not ours, not abuse, but the European Enlightenment for Mary Wollstonecraft has to be on tap, but not on top. This is what she's trying. She's in a more comfortable position, but certainly not allowed that tradition. I mean, journalists were in print calling her a bitch in the 18th century. That was not an easy word to print in those days, right? But because the language was restrained, but there she was. But we do not accuse her of her time and race. We do not find excuses for her. We enter her text with sympathy, locate a moment that we can inhabit and turn it around, use it within the caution for mere reason that the intervening centuries have established in us, the critical tradition. Now, when, obviously I'm not going to produce a reading, but just a few words, you know, to flesh out what I just said. You know, when she talks about women being treated as a kind of subordinate beings, that's in her book, second page of her opening, and she says that that means that woman is, quote, in the true style of Mahometanism, which is a Mohammedanism, you know. We do not simply accuse her of having a deeply prejudiced stance to Islam, which is, of course, correct, but place her next, for example, to Primo Levi, who, suffering 150 years later in Auschwitz, described the fact that the most abject, dehumanized creature in the concentration camp was described in turn as a Muslim. Now, this particular thing, to have the incredible misfortune to be in a situation where this was the term for, this had become a value term because of enmity, that's how we understand her. We don't confuse her with the monolithizing of Islam, let's say, in the Euro-US today. We look at the historicity of that situation, and when Mary Wollstonecraft expects to be understood by saying that, we think of her with other good people like Primo Levi, who were also tarnished, and then we think of ourselves. You see, this I said in a very, very early essay, which is my most reprinted essay, but I don't think Three Women's Texts and a Critique of Imperialism, that much space in the Vita for reprints, but much more than Can the Subaltern Speak, because it seems it's an easy fix. The colonizers are bad and we are good. It was an early essay, right? But on the other hand, it does say in it that when you see Charlotte Bronte being, I'll use the hard word, somewhat racist, what you begin to realize is that if so powerful an imagination could still be tainted by the time, what is it that we are tainted by? So to an extent, that's the lesson one learns when one goes into a Mary Wollstonecraft or a Primo Levi or a Kant, because there were many, many, many deep, resentful haters of Islam, but one Mary Wollstonecraft. So see how it is that history marks us as well. So that's one of the things. And then, what I will do, so what we are attempting to do is to look at history from within. I will then take a look, perhaps, since I don't read Arabic, I will read a book like Fazlur Rahman's once again in order to talk about Mary Wollstonecraft. So I always look at critiques that are coming from within. And you will know that slim prize-winning book full of documentation where Rahman, a devout Muslim, talks about the separation of ethics and the law. It's a fantastic book. So I will read that. I will look at all of the varieties of feminism that inhabit inhabit Islam today, and it is in that way that I will try to go toward Mary Wollstonecraft, so that I can take a corrective stance rather than simply accuse and distance with some kind of an adjective. In other words, I too am denied the right to be critical as I step into this place to view Wollstonecraft. So the situation of feminism, even the most benign and critically intimate, and I just recited the deconstructive politics of reading, even that kind of feminism is denied the right to critique, as I'm talking about what I do with an ur-text like Wollstonecraft. So, but I can, however, say that if we approach the text with this sort of critical intimacy, engagement, then on the very first page, when she begins her book, and she says, the first thing she says is that education is what must be given, good education is what is needed, then through that claim to the right to education, we begin to realize that Wollstonecraft can be taken beyond the European 18th century and related to all women everywhere. For one example, this is the desire expressed very recently by the former temple prostitutes in southern India for their daughters. So this is not to follow Wollstonecraft, but to save her from her own outlines. And once we are considering the field of education, we can step into the critical, unless we want to educate for globalization. That's a lost cause. You can't do any of this here. But if we enter the field of education, we step into the critical, as I have attempted to indicate in my discussion of Playing to Lose. There, old-fashioned cultural instruction can, old-fashioned community instruction can step forward and join with the foundational humanities inside the teaching machine. Because otherwise, one of the things that very famous opening paragraphs in Mary Wollstonecraft is not only not critical, but dogmatic, unfortunately, in the most abject way. Because the only objective fact that she can lay hold on is masculinity. So because the entire discussion, remember, 1792, there's nothing. The entire discussion of humanity that she has, so she says, and this is, we cannot even understand this sentence. If it be against the imitation of manly virtues, writes she, or more properly speaking, the attainment of those talents. See, when we talk about equality, behind that, mind you, the attainment of those talents and virtues, the exercise of which ennobles the human character, and which raises females in the scale of animal being, when they are comprehensively termed mankind, all those who view them with a philosophic eye must, I should think, wish with me that they may every day grow more and more masculine. This text has to be saved rather than simply put in its place. When there is nothing, what do we say? What are we touched by? What is there? What can we inhabit so that the text can be turned around? And what we can inhabit is that insistence upon education. Not just, remember that yesterday we had a much longer, what time did that begin anyway? I didn't even look. Yesterday we had a much more complicated discussion of the importance of quality in education, but I won't go there now. I move from here to the extraordinary document, the place of which in the contemporary polity of Southern Africa is not known to me, but which occupies in the general feminist discourse a very important position, a position I will say as important as Wollstonecraft's text. So since this is your home document and you have historical connections to it, and some of you, I mean, you don't take it quite in that way, you will forgive me. I'm speaking as a general feminist. I refer, of course, to the Women's Charter for Effective Equality, 1994. Now, the thing is that it is quite possible to decide that you want to simply critique it for, it's a silly critique really, for essentialism. Okay, it's making a claim, it's saying our experience, etc. This is useless criticism. Because again, just as in the case of Wollstonecraft, you have to see from where it's coming. There is no way that a charter of this, a powerful and courageous charter of this sort, would speak in any other kind of language. It is that, it's not worth talking about that stuff. What I am saying, however, and I don't really have the right to say much, but this I can say. I am looking at the English version, of course. And it says English. This morning, we were having a very serious and important discussion about the absurdity of the politically correct translations produced for a document such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or the various southern constitutions, the one I know best is the Afghan constitution, fabricated in the US, which always suggests that there is another original. As for the UN translations, when you work on the ground with the human rights situation, public interest litigation and so on, those translations are absolutely of no use because they are translated in such a concocted high-level language that for people at the bottom, they are not meaningful. So that's not what you use. And the thing is that the words that get into among, for example, the 300 or more Austroasiatic tribals with whom I have worked, they use words like harassment, for example, you know, and or harassment, okay? Okay, those are real words. They're meaningful words. They change the word, the meaning of the words. They wouldn't understand the very high-level Bengali words that exist in the translation. So we were talking about that. So I'm not really talking, when I say I'm looking at the English version, I'm not talking about the version of the chapter in the indigenous languages of South Africa. What I'm, as you know, this morning, we also had a discussion about the subject person, the capital I, of the indigenous languages of South Africa. So that's not a discussion that I need to bring in here. What I am talking about, I'm a translator, an active translator, translated a great deal, I'm still translating, just translated, finished translating, Aimé Césaire. What I am talking about is that the meaning of a word does not travel unencumbered from synonym to synonym. And these kinds of translations, because they have to be done quickly so they're in place, and I think they should be done. They have a symbolic value. I'm not against them. But they are not really versions. They should be there, but for children's education, all kinds of things, for a kind of gesture of equality, but that's what they are. Because the meanings cannot move from languages with such a very different history, powerful oralities, and the absolutely elaborated means worked over, and therefore the linguists in the audience now do excuse me. I know nothing. I mean, literally, PhD is at zero. Sorry, English students, no, it's a very good PhD, actually. But the thing is, from that point of view, you see, you have to realize that these are not translations. What I to translate in right at the end in his last book, Derrida gives us an impossible task of translation. That doesn't seem so impossible in Africa. He says, before we start adjudicating, we should try to translate in all the languages of the world, beyond Latinity, the difference because you would have to search this out first, not look for synonyms. The difference in thinking, not just words, the difference between reasonable and rational. If you could actually really go toward it, not just in your mother tongues, in all the languages of the world, in the same spirit, I would say, that rather than locate ourselves in some silly criticism of claiming or drawing on experience or anything, we should locate ourselves, we who are not within the charter, we should locate ourselves on the word cognizance in the English version. Take cognizance of all women. Cognizance, a good, old, heavy, wonderful English word, Latinate English word, which was in that description of the critical in Kant. Cognition alone, not in fact, chain it to an object right at the beginning and develop something to do. So I would want, for those who have the time, and believe me, this morning's discussion, the custodians of the African languages at this university will agree with me, that this kind of work, the thinking that has to go into the idea of that cognizance, and not just the indigenous Southern African languages, but the languages of Africa, it's an impossible thing because that's not where the emphasis is, right? It would, in fact, be productive of practical results. This is, I'm emboldened and empowered to say this, frankly, after this morning's meeting, because I was writing right to the till the end, and this part was written in this way. You can see this is not old material. This is stuff that's come from what we were talking about. So this is, again, I repeat, I do not know enough to go on here, and I hope to be instructed, and I hope also that I will be able to say more. But this thing for a general feminist who looks at Wollstonecraft in that way, she would look, again, somewhat protected from critique, because it's not, we can't afford it. She would look at the charter in this way. So it is possible for my universities in India, if it is possible for my universities in India and the United States to establish a closer relationship with yours, I would be instructed in how to think the Women's Charter together with other kinds of historical traditions on the ground in Southern Africa. I offer this to you here simply as a mark of the limits of my ignorance, and I hope in the question period you will begin the way in which you can instruct me for future work. I want now to come to an extraordinary text recently produced in the United States, Judith Halberstam's The Queer Art of Failure. Before touching this text, let us suggest that in Wollstonecraft and the Charter, access to the tradition of the critique can be perceived as a luxury to come dependent on work. Here the question arose for us, does that mean that we take a moratorium on it? I suggested not so. I suggested a way to use it through affirmative sabotage, through critical intimacy. Do not accuse, do not excuse, embrace the text, locate yourself somewhere, turn it, use. Unfortunately, given that the feminist and LGBTQ tradition is not without internal strife and class mobility, the right to the critical tradition is often spelled out as a support of inertia at the top. This is what we're looking at. We see this at work in Halberstam's text. And here, as in the case of Wollstonecraft's oppositional stand, we must come forward to use this text, no accusation, no excusing, enter its principles, find where we can base ourselves in order for that use to extract medicine from poison. But it is harder. Because, as the title suggests, it is a celebration of passivity and failure. But it has to be read as much more tied to its time and space, the middle class, academic middle class in the United States, against what it perceives as muscular gay liberation and speaking about leadership and taking control, as in the general polity. It can therefore be useful to consider why, for that limited audience, a woman such as Halberstam would want to learn how to lose, but only to lose, not to play to lose. You see, this is legitimation by reversal of the agency, because as I was trying to say, playing to lose is an extremely powerful way to play, knowing how to play to lose, and then not knowing that winning might not be losing. That's a very powerful teacherly position. And this, on the other hand, is a kind of abdication on reason. This is the kind of extreme of the critical position where one doesn't realize that the critical position is doubly bound with the dogmatic. This is why, to go back to Kant, who's a very useful person, because he had, after all, the leisure of the theory class, he fractures reason. He would never admit that he had done so. For him, it was always, for the stereotype of himself as philosopher, reason was always one. But he actually breaks it in three and a half. So that's very, very different from just saying we want passivity and failure. So this is the corrective one offers, because I believe here critical theory is seen simply as an abdication of rational choice rather than its supplementation, and it's brand new, supplementation with a great deal of ethical work. In spite of the claim of the title, we learn right away that it is not very much more than, quote, a basic desire to live life otherwise. This, I think, is a good thing. You know, this, like education, you don't follow Halberstam, but you help Halberstam outside of her time and place. This is how one works, you know, to realize that we who cannot afford the critical are in a position to actually give a corrective to these very powerful European, well-known European texts. To say, oh, you know, dead white women or alive but American and so on, to say those kinds of things is really to prove that we have not learned how to claim our agency outside of our own enclosure. So to an extent, here we are caught again in a moment that we can inhabit perhaps this basic desire to live life otherwise. But it would be very hard to go with the celebration of Freud's theory of masochism, which we see, and say that the passive voice, that is the true domain of masochistic fantasy, that might be the transformative voice for feminism. You have to make a distinction between what you can save and what you can't save. So the risk of judgment, again, if this were not just a single talk, we could certainly sit down and talk about how does one risk judgment. And a very interesting thing about Kant is that he places, for him, as Arendt noticed, the place of judgment is the aesthetic rather than anything else. So anyway, you cannot go there. She suggests that the final phase of the masochistic fantasy, the boys are being beaten by the schoolteacher, progressing from a child is being beaten, transfers punishments definitely away from the body of the subjugated and onto the body of the oppressor. Now, I'm going to look at an Indian text. I don't know. Do I have time? No. How long have I spoken? I have 5 minutes. Okay, then I won't look at the Indian text. Let me just tell you what I'm going to say. I have 5 minutes. So, see this, I was going to look at fiction. You know, a piece of fiction, and the very last thing would have been something that I taught, that I learned in the field of activism in India, which is two people talking to me about defecating in the fields, my teachers. Gender difference, and access to caste shame, bodily affect. What does one do with that? Does one just simply solve this? I mean, this is about as much of a problem as you can have, and you can easily take a position there. But I live and work with these people, so for 25 years now, so I learned something. And so that I can't read to you. I went on reading Kant, etc. But right at the end, I was going to show, number one, that the idea of the other side being killed is not necessary by being transformed into an animal is not necessarily a model, and how to read this when it is represented in fiction. And at the very end, let me read the last paragraph, and that will tell you what it was. At the very end, I was going to say, one page, I can do 5 minutes. Okay, gender difference, two narratives, not yet evidence. A man walks with the feminist leader down a path strewn with human waste and says with ill-concealed pride, our toilets are free. When his mother is afflicted with cholera, a male co-worker's son with hepatitis, and since for lack of education, the man and the co-worker cannot use the free National Health Service, although the feminist leader can, and therefore spend a lot of money, they do, on medicine, it is possible for her to show by explaining the difficult prose of the World Health Organization into the regional language that they're paying the price of their free toilets through all of this payment and will continue to do so. When, on the other hand, a woman, a capable teacher who regularly teaches the books in the state curriculum outlining oral fecal disease, is asked why she doesn't use the toilet, 2,800 rupees paid by the feminist leader for her own use, added to her dwelling, she remarks, the men here are very courteous. They do not go near the fields which they know are being used by women for defecating. Now, this is a different kind of argument, gender solidarity through acknowledgement of gendered division of bodily affect. Indeed, Wollstonecraft would endorse her. There's a quote that one can read. This is not a question of obeying hygienic principles. In the feminist leader's case, this has been rearranged through the use of caste shame by class mobilization. Who has access to shame? Class mobilization through relatively recent European colonization. Is she simply interested in creating a, quote, middle class through the use of caste obedience? Then let's not accuse the elitists. This is not pre-modern to modern on the way to the postmodern. This is an acknowledgement of the relief map of modernity, calling for epistemological activism, leading toward slow but real changes, supplementing necessarily feudal problem-solving through learning to learn from below. I had just heard a brilliant paper by a female colleague in Baroda on the caste distribution of shame in the context of the women's Channa rebellion and other related resistances in Kerala, Christian missionaries and bare-breasted tribals, and heard her lengthily lectured by a male Delhi University historian because she had dared to cite Foucault. She is an epistemological activist for the historiographers, and I hope. I will learn more from her in the future. In the caste Hindu marriage, lajjaharan, or the removal of shame, is one mark of being married. When the feminist leader strips in the Euro-US gym locker room, she is married to colonial history through the rearrangement of caste shame, which was harnessed to a modernity sequentially and teleologically computed so that she can lead today. Yet that is still employing a sexual difference that doesn't acknowledge the plurality of genders. If there are unisex or gender-diversified locker rooms somewhere in the world, the female leader does not know it. And we begin to notice that as the problem gets relocated by caste to race and class shift, we approach a reduction to absurdity. It announces the rupture into post-feminism. I come here then, unaccommodated woman standing in the locker room, through my definition of critique from the Kantian effort to fracture and constrain mere reason by way of a reason unavailable to understanding at the inception of capitalist colonization. I discussed Wollstonecraft and marked the charter in an act of feminist piety, open to instruction, as both not having permission to the critique as such in two altogether different ways. I have looked at Judith Halberstam's important text as taking the critical to be an invitation to passivity, and then differentiated, which I didn't do, between two kinds of Indian texts, one a piece of fiction and the other this stuff which I read so fast. I have tried to be mindful that first we use the European Enlightenment as an instrument to hand, which came into being in the service of colonialism and free trade, and secondly, that texts such as Wollstonecraft must be read by way of a deconstructive politics of reading, medicine to poison, by way of critical intimacy, and poison to medicine the other way. Finally, I have insisted that the lessons learned in the field of activism are not simply to be ignored as an embarrassment or a romantic golden ageism. Thank you.